I have hope in you guys. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, bye. Jeannie. You give us hope. Appreciate you listening.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
I'm Lisa Hale with WISS News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anytime at the WISS website at WISS.FM.
Hey, it's John Mino.
And Jim Schmidt from Mino and the Mayor.
Want to stay in the loop with all things Northeast Wisconsin? Sign up for the WISS weekly newsletter.
Get the latest local stories, updates on the weather, and a special feature from our Mino and the Mayor podcast.
It's your one-stop shop for real news and great conversations in Northeast Wisconsin.
Log on to WISS.FM today and get signed up.
Real news, great conversations. Get signed up today at WISS.FM/newsletter.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Donald Trump, quote of the day from Donald Trump. One of these things that just, it's hard to have it come off your tongue without laughing. But according to DJT, quote, our country in the 1890s was probably the wealthiest it ever was. Now, you go, but Rick, it was wealthy for the handful, the Trumps of the world, the Elon Musks of the world, the Jeff Bezoses, for the billionaire class. It was great for them. The 1890s was good. It was good. And you know we're in the middle of the second Gilded Age when Fortune magazine is putting out an article saying, yeah, We're essentially in the new Gilded Age. When you have workers being laid off by the thousands, when CEOs and shareholders are gobbling up massive amounts of profits, yeah, we're in a screwy spot where competition is non-existent, where regulations are being deregulated, where the wealthy can splurge. And look, they don't even have to hide the wealth anymore. You know, when I was younger, the rich people, they didn't flaunt it as much. And then you saw look at how well they used their money. They built nice homes. Now we're seeing, again, just opulence and insanity. And when you look at a company like Meta, who's making huge, enormous profits, only to then announce the layoff of 10,000 workers, naming this the year of efficiency because, hey, we gotta worry about profits, while simultaneously buying $90 billion of their shares back. Something is amiss. You know, this last year, back in 2022, the last year they keep track for this, stock buybacks hit, what was it, $681 billion? 23, they said, probably hit a trillion. And what we're seeing is we're seeing Reaganomics working its magic, because until Reagan, stock buybacks were illegal. It was a form of stock manipulation that we said, no, that's bad. We don't want that, until the Reagan era, to where we started pushing heavily for deregulation. Got to get government out of our lives. Well, not out of our lives, out of their lives, out of the wealthy's lives, so that they can, well, do whatever they want. And the reason I bring this up, yes, Donald Trump says dumb stuff, but he went on during this rally in Michigan recently. Now, understand, we are in the second Gilded Age. The gap between those who have and the rest of us is growing even larger and larger. This is even worse than let them eat cake. Trump went on this weave. He says, quote, we're lowering taxes. We're going to use tariffs very, very wisely. You know, our country in the 1890s was probably the wealthiest it ever was because it was a system of tariffs. We had a president, you know, McKinley, right? Remember Mount McKinley? And then they changed the name. There's the weave. But, you know, one of the good things, one of the really very good businessmen, we were a very wealthy country. Whatever the hell all that means. One, McKinley was never a businessman. He was a lawyer. Two, Mount McKinley in Alaska has been renamed Denali National Park. And I've been there. It's beautiful. It's amazing. I'm not sure how all that plays into tariffs, but he's got something. He's got like a dog. He's got a bone. And that bone is we're gonna have tariffs. And look, I'm somebody who's not 100% opposed to tariffs. I think you have to use them in a strategic way to ensure that you protect your industries that are vital to your international interests and to protect employment. And you do that in a strategic way. Broad blanket, broad-based tariffs, I think, are a bad idea. I say this all the time. I am a protectionist. When I leave my house, lock the door. I'm not an isolationist. I don't have a giant moat around my house. The idea of these broad blanket across the board for everyone, that's isolationism. You don't want to do business with anyone because no one's going to want to come in. But what's more important is this fascination with the 1880s and 1890s. Because what we forget about the 1890s, because we never really learned, is that we had one of the worst stock market crashes in the history of this nation. And one of the worst depressions that this country has, second only to the Great Crash in 29 and the Depression of the 30s. It was bad for working people. You know, small businesses went belly up. You know, small banks went belly up. And who gobbled everything up? The wealthy. So when he says it was the wealthiest we've ever been, who's we? Orange man. It wasn't the working people. It wasn't the townsfolk. It was the owner class. It was the people who had the wealth to gobble up for pennies. The property, the land, the businesses, the machinery. And oh, by the way, underpay the workforce. Not new. Something that they've done very well every time they collapse our economy. Gross domestic product plummeted. And no working person in their right mind, even the red hats in the arena, if they learned about the 1880s and 1890s, would ever want to go back to the era of monopolies and deregulation and the Carnegies having, you know, basically ultimate power. But he points to this tariff act of 1890 because we got tariffs, which some argue brought us the next depression. But it's this fascination with a new toy. And I love the old Mark Twain quote. What is the chief end of man, he asks? To get rich. In what way? Dishonestly if we can, honestly if we must. This is that. This is recreating the environment of the 1880s. And I say this all the time. Republicans want to take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s. I've been saying this for years. It's not just a cute little funny quip. It is actual reality. They want to take us back to the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s. And I've been saying this for years, and now, here with Donald Trump, they're finally saying it out loud. Understand, in the 1890s, 11 of the 12 million people, families that lived in this country earned less than $1,200 a year. The average annual income was about $380 a year. Bring that into our dollars. If you were lucky enough to make $1,200 a year, it was $41,580 in today's dollars. But if you were one of those families that earned $380 a year, that's only $13,167 in today's money. And you go, well, what does that mean? It means real income, real median income in 2023 was $80,000 and was over $80,610. The poverty level for a family of three is $25,820. The poverty level for an individual, over $15,000. A family back in 1890 was making less than just over $13,000. Poverty was rampant in this country. But power and wealth, that was controlled by the handfuls. That was controlled by the Bezoses and the Musks and the Trumps. That's what the fantasy is. That's what the fascination is. That's why they're so, we're going to go back to this. Because they know most of the people in the crowd, the red hats, they're never going to go do their own research. Because dear leader said it. But for the rest of us, the sane and rational among us, the 80s and 90s, the 1880s and 90s, not good times. In fact, the time when Jay Gould is quoted as saying, I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. What are we doing today? Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, Tuesday, Donald Trump shows up to Allentown after the Sunday comments about, Puerto Rico being an island of garbage or something by some nut job comedian. And I guess you, on a certain level, you have to have, be in awe of the size stones that Donald Trump has to go into one of the cities in Pennsylvania that has one of the largest Puerto Rican populations in this state and to just walk right in like nothing happened. He did not get a very warm response. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what was said on Sunday, and maybe this is what's going to move Pennsylvania. I've asked a good friend of mine, longtime friend, guy who's been on this show numerous times over the years. Abe Amoros is a labor buddy, community and political activist, and proud member of the Puerto Rican community. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick. It's great to be here.
So, thoughts?
Rick, I was absolutely incensed. Absolutely incensed. We are United States citizens. We get the least amount of respect as United States citizens. And we've been United States citizens since 1917 when the Jones Act was ratified by Congress. These comments are harmful. They're hate-filled. They inspire absolutely no one. And they bring the wrong elements to the table. I'll tell you, I was incensed. In fact, I'm still incensed and I'm trying to control my temper because this has legs. This has a lot of people up in arms. Now, the fortunate thing is it has mobilized Latino communities and Puerto Rican communities, especially in Allentown. And by the way, I lived in Allentown when I was a child. When I first came from Puerto Rico, I lived in the city of Allentown. I understand the growing population and the dynamics. I also served as managing director for the city of Reading, which is 67% Latino as well. And the mayor and I have had several discussions on this, and they're up in arms and they're really, really angry. They're frustrated, but to their credit, they're using this as an opportunity to mobilize, to get more attention to it, to vote and actually make it matter. And how fitting that a woman of color, of Black and Indian descent, could be propelled to the White House on the shoulders of the least respected poor brown and Black people in America. I think that that would be absolutely fantastic, and that would send the right signal to the rest of America that racism at any level, including jokes and humor, is absolutely wrong.
Well, let me ask you about that. Did you brought up the jokes and humor? I've had people make that. Oh, he was just kidding. It was just a joke. I'm sorry. I don't see it.
You're right, Reagan. That's how it starts. That's how it starts. And then the old trope is, oh, I can't believe that you're so sensitive about that. And then that's how it starts. When you start to normalize, when you start to
yeah. But hey, hold on. When the joke is, the Puerto Rican people have come here and are basically, I can't legally use the language that he used. But basically, you know, screwing over the country and keeping it in there to get the job done, if you know what I mean. Finishing, if you will, because that's what those people do. I'm sorry. I think I'm missing the point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely right. You know, we try to normalize really awful behavior in this country. And since 2016... we have begun to see the gains that have been made over the past 50 years start crumbling bit by bit. Because if the occupant of the White House, the previous occupant of the White House, can get away with those awful, horrific, racist, god-awful statements, that gives everybody else permission to do the same at work, to do the same in their neighborhoods, to do the same in schools. It's tragic. It's tragic. We have begun to descend in terms of civility, in terms of discourse. We have begun to openly hate one another because of one person. Make no mistake about it, that one person has legitimized evil and rottenness in this nation.
But what do you say? You know, because I've got a lot of response of, one, it was just a joke. It was just one guy. You know, they didn't. That's not what Trump believes. And I might give them some leeway if this were the first time.
Or it's not an isolated incident.
If this were the 100th time. If this were the 1,000th time. I might go there. I might even go, it was one guy in the entire hate fest that Trump called a love fest. But it was a common theme through almost every speech of attacking us and dividing us and tearing this country apart under some bizarre flag of weird patriotism that they're trying to create. I would give one guy maybe a pass, but it was all of them, Abe.
That's right. That's exactly right, Rick. It wasn't just Puerto Ricans and Latinos, but he demonized Jews, he demonized Palestinians, and he even made a stupid watermelon reference with an African-American in the crowd that he pointed to. This is not new. This all started in 2015 when he started campaigning, when he first called Mexicans rapists and drug dealers. Then he goes off on the Kung Flu and making all kinds of horrible statements, including statements against Mitch McConnell's wife. It's absolutely dreadful. And then he has the audacity to sit there and say that there were good people on both sides in Charlottesville, just hoisting that Nazi flag and carrying it with him everywhere he goes and waving it. What that was on Sunday was just a horrific example of where we have descended in terms of race relations. And racism is rooted deeply in fear and demonizing others because you feel that they are less than you because they have a different shade of color, they have a different accent, they come from a different part of the world, forgetting that this nation was built upon immigrants. When the Irish, the Italians, the Greeks, the Polish, and the Germans, when they were all being demonized, people were against that. And now they should be against what's happening now with people of color. It's wrong. We've contributed more than our share to this nation in terms of the military defense, in terms of building this nation, in terms of taking jobs that nobody else wants to take. And this is one of the reasons why corporations go out of their way to find labor south of the border, because no one else is willing to do those jobs. But we don't talk about that. We talk about demonizing them, making them the enemy. We make jokes about them. We call their island garbage. I mean, I'm telling you, man, I am just incensed beyond belief that this is even happening in the United States in 2024, and that the standard bearer, the nominee of the Republican Party, has embraced this hatred and then has the audacity, the cojones, to brush it off like it's nothing. Oh, you people are being so sensitive. And I'm really hoping, and I do believe sincerely, that the Puerto Rican community is going to turn out in droves on Election Day and hand him a much-deserved loss.
Let me ask you about that, because, again, I have a friend who's a political operative who, you know, I talked to on Monday, who said, you know, the Puerto Rican community in Allentown, because that's where he's at, was not really engaged. There was almost nothing in this election, he said, for them. This has lit them up because, you know, maybe they were going to vote. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were going to vote for Democrats. Maybe they're going to vote for Republicans. This seems to be a uniting thing. Are you getting the same kind of vibe through your contacts?
I certainly am, Rick. And let me equate it to this. How angry are Americans when their flag is burned? I want you to think about that for a minute. That sends all kinds of horrible, nasty feelings throughout your body. You almost come to the point of violence when you see flag burning. So when you call someone's native island garbage, that's even a step higher. You simply don't say that about our island. You don't say that about our Commonwealth. And you don't say it because we're Americans as well. We keep forgetting that.
And well, it'd be like saying South Carolina's garbage.
That's exactly right. Or Mississippi. I mean, pick any of the southern states, pick any state in the United States and demonize it. See how far that gets you. But you see, this is a wake-up call. And this is going to be a rude wake-up call, not just for Trump, but the Republican Party that has maintained its silence, its complacency, and has allowed that rot to enter into its foundations.
Now, the garbage comment, I had someone email me and go, well, Puerto Rico is garbage, and no one's done more for poor Puerto Rico. And I can't believe someone actually wrote this. No one's done more for Puerto Rico than Donald Trump. And my response back, well, I'll let you throw out the response.
Aside from throwing paper towels at us,
that was the response,
making us look like crap. No, absolutely not. That's just a tired, lazy talking point that somebody concocted, somebody wrote down, and another person memorized. It's that simple. That man has done absolutely nothing in terms of the infrastructure of the island that needs attention. And I was very pleased to see that Kamala Harris has decided to put together a task force to examine the electrical grid on the island, which went kaput 2 weeks ago because they have real infrastructure issues. They have economic development issues. But nobody talks about the good stuff either. Nobody talks about the military presence in Puerto Rico and in terms of us volunteering for our military. Nobody talks about the number of college graduates that the island is cranking out. Nobody's talking about the improving, slowly improving healthcare system on the island, but it is. Nobody talks about those things. They'd rather talk about jokes. They'd rather talk about demonizing poor brown people. It is enough is enough.
Yeah.
And at the ballot box, that's the best place to address this, so the voices are finally heard in a meaningful and constructive fashion.
So since we're talking about garbage, you know, President Biden weighed in. I'm not thrilled with the comment. I think it was ill-advised. But I can see how you get there. He said that, you know, the Trump supporters, you know, that they're garbage. The people who are going to support someone who would say this, that they're garbage. Now, I may agree with, you know, the people who support Trump and look past this as being garbage, but ill-advised?
I think it was ill-advised, Rick, and I hope that it does not counter the gift that was handed to the Harris campaign on Sunday. Now, let me just say this. Not all Trump supporters are racists, but I guarantee you that every racist is a Trump supporter. Racism is garbage. And by default, those who practice racism should also be considered to have garbage-like thoughts. Now, not personally, that doesn't get you anywhere. And when we personalize those attacks, it makes us just as bad as the other side, which has absolutely no scruples whatsoever. So I'm going to stick to that. Racism is garbage. And those who employ racism, they're headed in that direction as well. So they need to really check themselves and look at themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, what do I truly believe in? What is acceptable? What is not acceptable? Where does the line for decency get crossed?
Yeah.
Because, again, not all Trump supporters are racists, but I guarantee you that all racists are Trump supporters.
No, unquestioningly. But, you know, for me, this is another example of, you know, the old Jay Gould quote, the quote attributed to the railroad magnate Jay Gould back in the 1880s when he said, I could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. Because we're divided on race, we're divided on gender, we're divided on orientation, we're divided on a whole bunch of things.
Yes.
And generally it's right, left, it's, you know, blue collar, white collar, green collar, ringing around the collar. It's all the ways that pit us against each other. When the reality is the true division we should be looking at is the division of up and down. The fact that we have a handful of extraordinarily, enormously wealthy people who are benefiting from all of the things that this country has to offer, while we have struggling communities like Allentown, like Reading, like York, like Lancaster, a lot of Chicago and parts of Chicago, parts of Cleveland, there are where poor people live. There's been a disinvestment, and there's real problems that we could address if we had the priority.
That's exactly right. But we choose to do other things instead of coming together, instead of realizing that we have more in common than what actually divides us. We pick these horrible things.
Yeah.
And they're artificial, because you know what? I got to tell you something. We should be looking at this from an economic standpoint, a blue collar standpoint. We're all workers, man. I don't have any millionaire friends. I don't know any billionaires personally, all right? We are all here in this space together, and we ought to be trying to communicate with each other, get along better, and create greater economic opportunities for other people as well, because we're all in this fight together.
That's
we're all in this struggle together. One of the things that pains me the most, Rick, is how the South politically became so right-wing and conservative when we all have the same economic battles. Poor brown people, poor bright white people, blue-collar brown people, blue-collar white people. We all have the same things in common, yet they choose to divide us on social issues. God, gays, guns. I mean, we pivot to issues that are not as important as we make them out to be, and we cherry pick these divisions to demonize others. It is insidious at best.
Yeah. No, I grew up in a minority community.
Yes.
To me, it wasn't about black and white. It was about green, because we were all broke at the end of the month. There was no food in anybody's house, except that guy who got the union job that gave them the ability to afford a better life. That's where we should be fighting for. But Abe, I appreciate the thoughts. I wish you the best. I hope this does spark some get out to vote, and people do. And well, I'm hoping Pennsylvania goes the right way.
Yes, sir. And what I've seen so far, Rick, is very encouraging. People are mobilizing right now because of that anger. And I'm telling them, turn that anger into action, and that action is in voting on Election Day, getting everybody out.
Abe, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be here with you.
My good friend, Abe Amoroso. I want to hear your thoughts. You seeing this in your community? I want to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
This is Oshkosh Air Support, WISS. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low in the upper 30s. For tomorrow, clouds return, a chance of showers in the late afternoon, and especially by night, a high in the mid-50s. And staying in the mid-50s on Sunday, cloudy with areas of rain. Clearing out for Monday. Currently, it's 44 degrees.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Tom, your thoughts.
I don't believe that people don't know who Trump is at this point. And they have willfully decided to ignore everything he has said in order to vote what they think is the most important thing. And that's what voting is all about. But you can't claim ignorance when it comes time that Trump is going to pull the trigger and do some things that are going to hurt you and your family. That's what's probably going to happen.
Yeah.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
As you know, we're just a couple of days from Election Day. This is the final weekend before the big Tuesday that's coming up. And, you know, we see, and we've been talking to union leaders across the country about getting out there and getting members motivated, explaining why their union chose one candidate over another, what it is that they've done. That's why I've asked my good friends at the Bricklayers Union to come share some thoughts with us, the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Crafts, about how they plan on helping to lay the foundation for a more prosperous future. That's why I've asked Keith Hossover to come talk with us. Keith is the Executive Vice President of the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
Ah, no problem. My pleasure.
So this frame that I'm using, laying the foundation for a more prosperous future, I think good policy, smart investment, that's the way we lay that foundation. And yes, I chose that because you're a bricklayer. This to me seems like a no-brainer election. Who'd you endorse and why?
Kamala Harris. I mean, we've in the what the Harris campaign, Harris-Waltz campaign has done is, I think, made a promise to the workers to extend what Joe Biden and Harris has already done for us over the last 4 years. And I think that, you know, the where they have put us with the amount of infrastructure money and the chip plants and battery plants, I think we're in a generational moment where this is a moment where there's going to be more work done by skilled trades women, men and women in the union than ever has been in our lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, with the money coming in.
And this is one of those things that I said when Trump became president. I said, if Donald Trump gets an infrastructure package pushed through, because there was talk at the time, you may remember, you know, mm-hmm. Trump makes big promises. They're grandiose promises. We're going to have a $3 trillion infrastructure bill, he was saying. And I remember mm-hmm. that. I said, look, if he passes a $3 trillion infrastructure package, there's no chance he's not reelected, no matter what, because that's going to make the country much more prosperous. The reverberation effect from the good wage jobs that'll be created will just get communities booming. Instead of tax breaks for billionaires, how about we start building stuff? Had he done that, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But he didn't, and he was never going to. So when you're out there talking to your members and you hear them say, well, Donald Trump's got a plan. No, there's no plan.
No, his plan is to lie to you. Really, his plan is to just make things up as he goes. And I think that's what happened when he was in office. He mentioned about infrastructure money, one, to the building trades, and something to do to protect our pensions, to help our pensions, the ones that were failing. And that just didn't happen. So when Biden got in, he changed that around. And he really, I mean, he knows what we need to strengthen the middle class. And I think Kamala Harris does as well. Right. And I think what they're doing is really expanding on the strength and building up a middle class again in the United States that we haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, I was speaking to another building trades leader, and I said, you know, it's the old Monty Python bit. You know, what have the Romans ever done for us? And then they tick off 1,000 things at the rum. Well, of course that. Do you get the same kind of response when you're out on the job sites from your members going, well, what has Kamala Harris ever done for us?
I think what we run into more is we're trying to educate our members more on project labor agreements and prevailing wage and what goes into a pension that makes it strong and healthy, and what are those variables and how politically the decisions that are made affect those areas. And so for us, if we get out and our members understand what a project labor agreement is and how that affects the infrastructure money coming in and how that allows union workers to be able to work on these projects that are government funded, they start looking at it differently. Because when I talk, I've been traveling around the battleground states. I just got back from Pennsylvania, I was in Pittsburgh, Erie, and I was in College Park where Penn State is, and talked to members there. And you know, when you start explaining to what the infrastructure money coming in and how project labor agreements and how many project labor agreements are going to be covering that money coming in and the work near their homes, traveling. I mean, the amount of work coming in is just going to be astounding. So yeah, if they believe in that and they want to keep that going, their choice will be to vote more pro-union. And in order to do that, just to understand what basic principles are.
Yeah, know, I've asked that question to a number of labor leaders, and the response has always been, well, the job you're working on, that's what they've done for you. They got the money to help rebuild this infrastructure project that you're going to spend the next year or two, feeding your family with. That's what they've done. And what I would argue is what Donald Trump would take away, because they've said that they're going to not spend the unspent money. If you look at Project 2025, you brought up PLAs, project labor agreements, and prevailing wage, I know we'll talk about. They're against both of those things, which for someone in the building trades, that should be like the giant red line that you just, if you're against those, there's no way that you should be voting for somebody.
Yes, exactly. And I think when you try to peel back why, I think the easiest way to look at it is maybe they just don't understand as well on what that does. And the fact that a project labor agreement is actually a contract between an owner and the union. And it basically lets everybody know on that project that it's going to be done by union men and women and the skilled trades. So I think that in and of itself is one of the biggest things that we have going for us. Is once they start realizing that and what voting union means, yeah, okay, that's that's what union means. And yep, if you want to even throw in, because a lot of times I don't try to dog Trump too much when we do talk, because it just kind of makes him kind of set back. But I tell him, remember that Trump took away your tax deduction for your dues. So your dues deduction used to be that. So the only thing he did do to the unions is take your tax deduction off and give it to the rich.
Yeah. So yeah, you stop and think about that for a second, because I've got a lot of union friends who love Ronald Reagan and they love Donald Trump. And I go, you know, If you remember, Ronald Reagan was the first president to tax unemployment benefits, and we've been taxing unemployment ever since. I think a giant slap in the face to someone who loses their job. And now you got Trump, who took away your deductions for your union dues and for your work gloves and your boots and all of those other things that you used to be able to deduct, so that he could give bigger tax breaks to Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. And they're like, it's very stark to me. It's very clear to me. But you bring up two things that I don't think most people understand: prevailing wage and project labor agreements. And, you know, when you talk about those things, for me, it's about getting the best value for our tax dollars and building the best product that we can get, whether it's a school or a bridge or a hospital or whatever we're using our tax dollars for. I want them used in the best efficient way possible, but also in the best quality way possible. And I always look at the difference between what was the replacement for the Tappan Zee Bridge and that monstrosity out in California, the Bay Bridge, that's never going to be completed. One was done with a project labor agreement with prevailing wage, done on time, under budget. And the other out in California, well, they tell me it will never officially be done. So it seems the proof is in the pudding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's one, that's something that we're really proud of. And I think that's why, when it comes to Harris and Walz supporting project labors and project labor agreements and prevailing wage, it's so important, because what they're doing is basically putting and making sure that people that work on these projects are getting an area standard wage. They're not getting taken advantage of. They're getting paid what that craftsman or craftswoman should be getting paid to perform that type of work, because construction work is not easy work. It's physical work, and every single block you lay, there's a chance you can hurt yourself. There's a chance that, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen. But if you're able to take and get skilled tradeswomen to come and build your building or your bridges, if you're going to pay a substandard wage, that's what you're going to get, substandard workers, because the work environment now is it's too hot and workers are too valuable and they know it.
Yeah. So no, look, you know, I make the argument for prevailing wages. I want the best skilled people. And the reason I think prevailing wage is important is it encourages a local building trades. In places that have done away with prevailing wage, what you saw were the most skilled craftspeople basically leave the industry, go where their skills could take them to earn the wages that they're worth. So you end up with transients coming through, throwing up halfway done jobs, and then moving on to the next thing. And I've said it all the time, if they're going to put a roof on my kid's school, I want somebody living next door to me who's got a kid in that school working on that roof. Because if it collapses, his kid's sitting there too. I think he's going to work a little bit harder, do a little bit better job to make sure that it's done right.
Oh, amen. And, you know, what we do is you take and use local building trades, and you know that they have been certified in certain materials. They've done this specific task and been taught how to do this specific task with this material. So we know material limitations. We know a lot of things that someone that doesn't understand how to, that maybe done one or two roofs or maybe did a plumbing here or done. If you're going to take government money and be fiscally responsible with it, you're going to want people building your buildings that are going to be built one time correctly with the proper materials installed the right way. So guarantees and manufacturer warranties stay in place. And if you do that, you're going to have a building that you can build once, and it can be a career maker, not a career breaker. So if you use substandard wages, then you end up having to get more tax dollars taken out to fix the building that you already built once. And really, it doesn't help with any kind of a progressive type of movement with any kind of city or anything to get, you know, to grow in a positive direction, because you never actually move out of the, you're always going back to the one building that you've been working on.
Now, the reason I bring this up is, and I think it's really important, because, you know, it's election time, it's decision time. And each party, each candidate in this case, Donald Trump on one side, Kamala Harris on the other, have staked out positions. And they're very clear positions. There isn't a lot of room. There's a massive amount of room between them. You know, generally you could go, well, there's not a lot of room between the Democrats and the Republicans. They're all the same. No, there's a lot of room, especially on this issue. Project 2025 is very clear. Do away with prevailing wage, do away with project labor agreements. Cheapest bid gets the contract. So, whatever. Deregulate. So we don't even have to worry about regulations. So who knows what we get? On the other side, you've got Kamala Harris saying, look, we want good wages for workers. We want good conditions for communities. We want sound regulation to make sure that those buildings are done right. This seems like an election about what kind of a country really do we want going forward. Do we want the Wild West where the wealthy and big corporations have all the power and control? Or do we want to have some control? It seems that stark to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think when you come, we're living in two realities. So some people that are looking at this, they're getting fed a different reality than the other side is. Because, you know, I've talked to, immigration comes up when we go on job sites sometimes. All right. I travel a lot over the United States and Canada, and I talk to a lot of workers, both here legally and that came here legally and not legally. All right. And when you're talking to workers like that, that are being taken advantage of, because most of the time the illegal immigrants getting taken advantage of, they're afraid.
Yep.
They're not going, they're not a malicious group that I've been running into. They're afraid. They just want to work. They want to have a lot of them come from areas that are full of drug cartels and an influence where the police and there's no law. And they just want to get somewhere where they can have a, you know, raise a family. So if you're trying to do that and then you're on the other side, you're looking at it that it's a swarm of criminals coming in. I don't know. It's hard to get everything to a point where can we have a conversation where facts and the truth matter? Because sometimes we're getting into stats and figures now that get made up and you really don't know what up and down is. So once we get back to up and down and get, you know, and okay, I agree with this, you agree with this, okay, fine, we agree with that reality, then we can actually move forward and try to have a decent conversation. But I think they're getting pumped with, a lot of these people are getting pumped with a lot of misinformation on things that just aren't truths.
And that's why I reach out to you guys to get this stuff, because the reality is on the immigration issue, prevailing wage and project labor agreements are a good way to make sure that that everyone's paid a reasonable wage, that contractors aren't able to exploit and abuse undocumented labor by undercutting local employment. So this should be a central issue. I don't care who the status of someone doing the job is. I want to make sure that the conditions, the wages, the benefits, all that stuff are the same for everybody in these industries so that there's no incentive to abuse and exploit for these contractors.
Oh, yeah. And that's what they're doing is exploiting them, you know? So anytime you're exploiting workers, you run into dangerous people, really. So being able to have the enforcement needed through the government, through the Department of Labor, all right, having wage and hour investigators, people that can actually go out and perform the tasks of enforcing the law. You know, when Trump came in, you take the Department of Labor, you take all the police, really the construction police, and get a bunch of them and take them out of the way. Well, guess what? Then you can let the illegal crime just run amok because no one can catch up with it. You know what I mean? So.
No, I mean, we're in an interesting moment. So last line of questioning I've got for you, as you're out talking to your members, as you're out explaining how important knowing what's in Project 2025, as you're explaining Kamala Harris's position on continuing the Biden legacy of investing in our infrastructure, are they receptive? Are you getting people who are seeing the light bulb go on? What kind of responses are you getting?
Oh, the light bulb going on, the faces, because you can see when you, the best way to talk to a person is looking them in the eye, shake their hand and say, hey, Project 2025 is talking about 160 hours before you get overtime, if you get it. All right. It's talking a lot of things within Project 2025 sound so amazing that that couldn't happen. That couldn't happen. And they're talking their way out of it. So I think the strength of Project 2025 and getting the information to the members has been good. How much of it and what parts of it, like the overtime and, you know, things like that. It kind of, it's fallen, it's hitting well, but I think that when it comes down to our members deciding is getting the education that they need in Project 2025 and what could possibly happen is a part of it. But I've been trying to do more of the promoting of the good things that have come out that we don't want to lose, because so many times the unions are so used to playing defense, and the first time we're actually on a level playing field where we can actually play some offense with some of the card check advantages and certain things that are going on now.
Tick that off for me, because you're right. Most of us spend time on the what we're worried about, and I'm worried about everything that's in Project 2025 because it's 920 odd pages of conservative wet dream horrible. So it is bad for working people from top to bottom. If you just keyword look at any of it, it's bad. So you're right. We should be focusing on the great things, because I think the Biden administration has been transformational. I think we've moved away from a lot of the neoliberal nonsense. We're investing in infrastructure here at home. We're reshoring manufacturing. There's a lot of really great positive stuff that we absolutely should be focusing on, and we do. So walk me through some of that real quick. You know, what is that elevator pitch on the positive?
The positive, I would say it all depends on the areas that I've been going in. I'm trying not to sound too pitchy. I think that
I'm working on a building project. I'm building a highway. Yeah, I got highway money. I'm building this project. What are you telling me?
Well, the infrastructure money coming in, and the not only battery plants. When we were at a few of these places, their battery plants are going to be coming close, and a couple of the chip plants. So when we talk about not only building that under project labor agreements, all right, we're talking about building that area around it and being able to take a market and take market share that will give us the strength to collectively bargain, because we're going to have the workforce in these areas in numbers that we've never seen before. So now that's going to allow us, if we do it right and we maintain our solidarity, that's going to allow us to actually go in and get our workers together, get them a decent wage. We can spread the knowledge of what it's like to be in a union trade and what it's like to get benefits. And if we can keep work around some of these plants going in a consistent basis, then we can take and actually grow up communities in ways that we haven't seen. So if you want to go back to what it was like in the 20s and 30s and for work for, unions, that's what it used to be like. So if you're going to go back with that, you want to go back with Biden and go back to the way unions used to be. Yeah. Not that they're weak now, but they were a different kind of market share back then when the laws were the way they are now, more pro-worker than it has been in,
If I got you right, we're on a good path. We're heading in the right direction. We're investing in stuff. We're building stuff. We're laying that foundation for a more prosperous future. The future is apprenticeships for younger workers to get trades, to be able to support their families and support their communities. All the stuff that my grandparents were able to do to build what was the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. We're on the cusp of doing that again. That I believe is your message. I think it's a good one. Keith, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always good talking with you, brother. Keep up the great work and get out there and knock on them doors.
You got it. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks.
Have
so
a great
much.
Day.
Our good friend Keith Hossifer, Executive Vice President at the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers. You can check out their website at bacweb.org. We'll get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you seeing stuff being built up? You seeing that foundation that's going to get us a more prosperous future? I want to hear from you. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that bringing in a scab driver to run an elevated train in Brooklyn, New York, ended in tragedy. Members of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers were out on strike against the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company. The company had fired several union members for wearing union pins. To keep the trains moving, the company hired replacements and put them to work with little preparation. Edward Luciano received far less than the 60 hours of training that operators typically received before he made his fateful run. The next day, the New York Times reported on the deadly results, writing, quote, "A Brighton Beach train of the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company made up five wooden cars of the oldest type in use, which was speeding with a rush hour crowd to make up lost time on its way from Park Row to Coney Island, jumped the track shortly before 7 o'clock last evening on a sharp curve approaching the tunnel at Malbone Street in Brooklyn, and plunged into a concrete partition between the north and southbound tracks. At least 93 people died. Some estimates were more than 100 killed. The operator and several company officials were eventually put on trial for manslaughter. No one was found guilty. The company did, however, pay out damages to some of the families. Negotiations between the company and the union would continue until 1920. The union eventually won most of its demands. In the years after the crash, new safety measures were implemented for elevated trains to help guard against human error.
Oh, the workers on the SP line to strike sent out a call. But Casey Jones, the union scabby, wouldn't strike at all. His boilers, they was leaking.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, one of the things I didn't bring up with Keith, you know, whenever you're talking to labor people, and I can't believe that the AFL hasn't done more with the Donald Trump, Elon Musk audio waxing poetic about firing striking workers. And it was one of those things that, you know, during the break I was talking with Keith and I said, you know, it's that giant red line. It's the cardinal sin. It's the mortal sin to say I'm against the right to strike. I think we should be able to fire striking workers. That's a mortal sin, I believe, in the labor world. One of those things that if a politician says that, they're done forever. There's no road to redemption. That's it. And hearing Trump say that and then compounding it with all of the other things that he's said over the years, that he's in favor of right to work, that, you know, his history of cheating workers and contractors out of wages, the bankruptcies that ultimately cheated workers and contractors out of wages. It's one of those moments where you go, giant red line. There should not be a labor person in this country. There shouldn't be a working person in this country that votes for a Donald Trump under any circumstance. Done. But sadly, and this is where I don't know that we've done a good enough job of educating the workforce. I think about when I started in the workforce, an old timer came up to me and said, "Hey, kid, we're going to make a Teamster out of you yet. You got a question, you come see me. You got a problem, you come see me. You got a question, I don't care about what, you come see me." You don't go to the boss, you don't go to the company, you don't go across the street, you come to me. And we will find the answer and we'll do it together. This idea of solidarity and unity among the workforce, and what the right has done masterfully through, you know, right-wing talk radio, through cable news, through all the podcasts that are out there that are targeted towards working people. It's about tearing us apart on every other issue and not talking about the economics. How you support your family is that job that you have. That's because of the job that you have. And ultimately, and I come back to this, ultimately, it's because unions fought for good wages. Unions fought for the 8-hour day that we had taken for granted. It's all been eviscerated to this point. Now they're talking about taking away the 40-hour work week. We could have a 160-hour work month. That will be fabulous. I'm telling you. This election is about a lot more than just the cult of personality. It's about what kind of a future do we want to have. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickssmithshow.com.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.